Good morning, everybody. Thank you for taking the time to tune into the podcast this morning. Just a reminder that our podcast only includes the sermon. For other elements, we'd encourage you to check out the service video, and you can find the link to the video version just to the right of your screen. And now, here's Pastor John.
Ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. These words pumped me up. They empowered and inspired me. I experienced a surge of adrenaline. I was ready. I was given that incentive to change the world, persuaded to do great things. But there were a couple of problems. First of all, the statement was made in the early 1960s. By an American president to Americans. I wasn't an American then, and I'm not an American now. The second problem is, in the early 1960s, I heard it when I wasn't even 5 years old. Now, for someone 5 years old to make a difference in the world, to be an agent of change in his country, in his hometown, even in his own home, is something that's rather limited. Yet, I was still greatly inspired by these words from JFK, President John Kennedy. Hey, Josh, are you related to... He is. Well, there you go. Yeah, you'll have to ask Josh about that when you see him next time. Yeah, these words were just wonderfully inspiring. It was one of those pithy statements that really captured my attention, stayed with me even as a young boy. I remember that motivational statement, and I remembered it just the other day on Wednesday when, during his throne speech, our Prime Minister declared, "Canada is at a crossroads. This is a moment for change, for the future, for our country." Now, maybe I've grown cynical in my adult years. I am skeptical of politicians' edicts, but I must tell you that motivational statement did very little to motivate me, to inspire me, or to empower me. Compare it to an encounter I had with a supervisor of mine when I was just a young emerging leader. This fellow looked at me and he said with confidence and conviction, six life-inspiring words, "I am committed to your success." Wow. I still remember those words. I felt like I felt when I first heard JFK. Have you ever had that feeling? Have you had a leader, a supervisor, or a manager touch you deeply, inspire you, encourage you, motivate you, persuade you to do great things? Have you had that kind of influence or impact on someone else? Motivation is defined as a way of getting people to do things. Even more, making them want to do things. Now, good, positive, effective motivation touches us deeply. It unleashes our deepest desires and ambitions. The best motivation gets the very best out of persuasion. Motivation is more than just a slick slogan or a catchy phrase that you would find on a t-shirt or on a pen or on a sign. No, the best motivation, effective motivation, is so much more than that. It's ongoing words. It's ongoing actions that stimulate, that provoke a wholehearted, enthusiastic response. And above all, effective motivation is motivating others without manipulating them. Now, on the surface, Nehemiah's great motivational statement in Nehemiah chapter 2 does not seem that impressive. It hardly seems all that motivating. Come, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem. That's not the kind of statement that you're going to find on a t-shirt or on a pen or on a display sign. If I had been Nehemiah's marketing consultant, I would have suggested to Nehemiah a statement like, "Let's get on the ball and rebuild the wall." Or maybe a statement like, "Hey, if you're a true Jew, join with me in the rebuilding the wall crew." But no, the secret to Nehemiah's ability to motivate and to motivate successfully can be found in words and actions of Nehemiah before and after his invitation to rebuild. What we need in our text today, Nehemiah 2, 11 to 20, is what I'm calling the good year blimp perspective. An overview of the field, an overview of the text, taking into account what Nehemiah said and did before his motivational statement and what occurred after it. For here we see in Nehemiah very vividly that a good leader is a good motivator. Show me a good leader, and I'll show you a good motivator. Now, we have been in Nehemiah for the last 3 weeks. You'll recall that we began in chapter 1 with Nehemiah discovering there was a problem in Jerusalem. The gates were burnt. The wall was broken down. He prayed that God would involve him in the solution to the problem. Then last week, we looked at Nehemiah as an emerging leader. We discovered some tools that Nehemiah had in his leadership toolbox. Do you remember some of those marks of effective leadership? An effective leader sets and achieves goals. An effective leader makes and develops plans. An effective leader overcomes opposition. An effective leader doesn't only lead, but he is one who is able to be led. A good leader is also a good follower. Well, this week we're going to continue with this theme of leadership, and we're going to look at the leader as a motivator, or as our title suggests, motivating others without manipulating them. We want to ask the question, how was Nehemiah able to mobilize people, able to persuade them to engage and to be involved in achieving and accomplishing a colossal building project? How did he do it? What was his secrets to motivating others? Now, a disclaimer. You need to know that this is not a sociology lecture, a psychology lesson, or a business class on motivational theory. This is not organizational behavior 101. But I do think that we can glean important insights on motivating others, especially for those of us who are called to lead in various aspects and areas of life. So if you have your Bible, please take it and turn to Nehemiah chapter 2. We're going to look at verses 11 to 20. Now I'm dividing it into two major sections. The first section, which could be called the pre-motivation, although I think it's just an important part of Nehemiah's leadership motivational strategy, is what I'm calling Nehemiah's silence. And then in our second section, we're going to look at what it was that Nehemiah said. For in this first section, we see that Nehemiah said, I had told not anyone what my God had put in my heart to do for Jerusalem. And later he says, because I had yet not said anything to the Jews and others about what I was about to do. So let's look at the first section and see how this contributes to Nehemiah's effective motivation strategy. So he says in verse 11, I went to Jerusalem, and after staying there 3 days, I set out during the night with a few others. I had not told anyone what my God had put in my heart to do for Jerusalem. There were no mounts with me except the one I was riding on. By night, I went out through the valley gate toward the Jackal Well and the Dung Gate, examining the walls of Jerusalem, which had been broken down, and its gates, which had been destroyed by fire. Then I moved on toward the Fountain Gate and the King's Pool, but there was not enough room for my mount to get through. The rubble was so bad. So I went up the valley by night, examining the wall. Finally, I turned back and re-entered through the valley gate. The officials did not know where I had gone or what I was doing, because as yet I had said nothing to the Jews or the priests or nobles or officials or any others who would be doing the work. Let's stop at that point. Nehemiah's silence. We might expect that when Nehemiah arrived in Jerusalem, he arrived to a great fanfare. It was an incredible procession, trumpets blasting, Nehemiah announcing, I'm here, I'm your rescuer, I'm your deliverer, let's get it done. But no, Nehemiah wasn't loud, he wasn't boisterous. He got there, I believe that he waited a while, he rested. You know what? A good leader, a good motivator, appreciates the importance of rest and refreshment. It had been a long journey for Nehemiah as he arrived in Jerusalem. He rested. I also believe he prayed. And he also experienced solitude. I've read a lot of books on the loneliness of leadership. But what about solitude? And the leader. Times where a leader needs to get away to reflect and to think about what's going on. So during this period, I believe that Nehemiah was reflective. He was circumspect as he looked at the situation. Though he wasn't talking to others, I believe that Nehemiah was doing a lot of listening. He was taking in information, absorbing and assimilating what people thought about what was going on in Jerusalem. But Nehemiah kept quiet. You know, as I think of Nehemiah's style, I think of a couple of leaders that I worked with on an elders board. Both very similar styles. Both been very successful in business leadership. But their style in a meeting was to wait, to watch, to listen, to observe, to take into account the opinion of others before they would weigh in, and they would often weigh in with profound advice. But it was built on this time of waiting and reflecting and observing. Hey, a good leader is willing to do that. He is willing to put in the time. Now, combined with this, Nehemiah, as we discovered, did some homework, some investigating. He did some research. Not only does this passage help biblical archaeologists in terms of the description of Jerusalem at this time, but it gives us this idea that Nehemiah wasn't satisfied with secondhand information. He wanted to discover for himself the nature of what was going on. How severe was the broken wall of Jerusalem? So he went out at night and he did this investigation. You know, a good leader, whether it be in business, at church, in the home, is willing to do that kind of work and research. It would be like Junior bringing home his report card. And Dad asked Junior, so how did you do? And Junior says, oh, I think I did okay. A good parent, a good dad, is going to take the time and read through that report card for himself. In order to make things happen, in order to see progress, there needs to be that kind of investment in doing that level or that kind of research. Please note as well for Nehemiah, this orientation towards understanding the problem. When I taught counseling, that was always a challenge because every student wanted to fix the problem right away. And I would explain to them the challenges you could end up with an unadulterated response, which means that you might be fixing a problem that's not really the problem. You need to be disciplined to understand and to be aware of the true nature of the problem, even to go into depth to understand it. This is what Nehemiah was doing here in Nehemiah chapter 2. We also see that this was hard work. It took a lot of effort. Hey, if you go into a bookstore and you see a book entitled Easy Leadership, Leadership that Requires No Effort, avoid that book. Leadership, good leadership, motivating others well is hard work. And Nehemiah invested. He put in the effort. He examined and he investigated the situation. So let's shift and look at verse 17 through the end of the chapter. Then, and only then, I said to them, you see the trouble we are in. Jerusalem lies in ruins, and its gates have been burned with fire. Come, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem, and we will no longer be in disgrace. I also told them about the gracious hand of my God on me, and what the king had said to me. They replied, let us start rebuilding. So they began this good work. But when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite officials and Geshem the Arab heard about it, they mocked and ridiculed us. What is this you are doing? They asked. Are you rebelling against the king? I answered them by saying, the God of heaven will give us success. We, his servants, will start rebuilding. But as for you, you have no share in Jerusalem or any claim or historic right to it. I want to highlight some of the steps that Nehemiah took in motivating the people of Jerusalem. Please note that before the invitation, come, let us rebuild, Nehemiah said these words, you see the trouble we are in. You see the trouble. This is called, in motivational theory, defining reality. Max Dupré and other leadership experts talk about this as being critical and vital when it comes to leadership and even in motivating others. Now, it's difficult. Many of us would prefer to avoid defining reality. We want to share good news. We want to be positive. We want to be popular as leaders. But the challenge is that tension, the synergy that needs to be there between bad news and then good news. There's a biblical pattern. The bad news is all have sinned and fall short of God's glory. The good, great news is Christ died for sinners. But before we really can appreciate the good news, we need that awareness of the bad news. You see the trouble that we are in. I can imagine that Nehemiah and the others weren't necessarily standing in one spot. He maybe was walking with them. They were doing a quick survey of what they had seen and what Nehemiah had observed over the last week. The gates were burned. The wall was broken. There was a real need here for some repair. The problem with that tension is that some people are so quick to get to the good news, the hope, the vision, the optimistic future, that they avoid presenting the hard facts, the reality. Others are so obsessed with the bad news that they offer no hope or no optimistic future. Nehemiah was able to balance both. There were people there who were struggling with hopelessness. They had been without a wall for a long time. Nehemiah wasn't blaming them. He didn't say, "What have you guys been doing? Like, this is awful. This is shameful." No, Nehemiah very tenderly spoke truth. He was honest. He trusted them, but he still was able to move on and offer hope. The other concern would have been complacency. The fact that they had been without a wall for such a long time, they had just gotten used to it. And Nehemiah was aware of that. Hey, that's a big issue, isn't it, with COVID-19? A lot of leaders would say, well, we want to protect people from the hard reality. Most of us would prefer to know the truth, even if it's difficulty. I don't particularly enjoy it when our leaders are updating us on the latest COVID-19 statistics, but we know it's necessary. We know it's helpful, especially if we're going to forge towards solutions. Hey, the other night I was in a meeting here at the church, and we made a great decision. We've decided that we are going to be getting new lights in the sanctuary and in the foyer. During the meeting, as we were talking about it and considering the cost and the investment, I can remember at a point thinking briefly, is it really needed? And then I paused and I took a look in the foyer where I often work. I like having a desk out during the week, a table where I can work on. But I looked up and I saw light bulbs that were some yellow, some more of a white color, a lot of covers missing. And I thought, wow, it really does need to be fixed. It needs to be repaired. We need new lights in the foyer and in the sanctuary. That's kind of how it is with Nehemiah. He invited people to consider the trouble. Actually, it's a strong Hebrew word, which maybe means more of the calamity, the desperate situation we're in. But did you notice that little phrase? The trouble we are in. You would have thought Nehemiah would have said, as one who had been in Persia for years, you see the trouble you are in. But no, he says, you see the trouble we are in. Not only did Nehemiah identify the problem, he identified with the people. This isn't Nehemiah saying it's you and me. It's us. It's we. Nehemiah takes ownership, and it's that kind of ownership that will lead to buy-in from the people. You see the trouble that we are in. Jerusalem lies in ruins, and its gates have been burned with fire. And it's at this point that Nehemiah offers hope. He offers this compelling vision for the future. Come, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem. Now, this is a great phrase. Though it may not be profound, it may not be the most memorable slogan you've ever heard, what's compelling about this is that Nehemiah was very clear. He was very concise. He communicated this goal of rebuilding and communicated it really, really well. Again, I'm not talking about motivational theory this morning, but isn't it interesting that Nehemiah taps into some of the needs of the people, the need to achieve, the need to be involved in something significant, a significant cause, a need to be challenged, and Nehemiah is offering this opportunity to the people. And then an interesting phrase. He says, "And if we do that, we will no longer be in disgrace." Now, if it had been me, I would have said, let's rebuild the wall so that we can be successful, so we can have the strongest defense capacity in the region. But no, Nehemiah keys in on this idea of being disgraced. Now, if you go back to chapter 1, when Nehemiah heard the report from his brothers and the envoy that came, they said, "Those who survived the exile and are back in Jerusalem are in great trouble and disgrace." Nehemiah tapped into the primary concern for the people in Judah at that time. There was that feeling of being in disgrace. They were defenseless, they were helpless when it came to their enemies. But there was a loss of pride. There was this sense of shame. And Nehemiah taps into it. He doesn't say that we are a disgrace. He doesn't say, oh, we are despicable. He says, let's do this rebuilding so that we will no longer be in disgrace. But there's more. He says, "I also told them about the gracious hand of my God and what the king had told me." I love this. It's as if Nehemiah is telling his story. And where Nehemiah could have said, let me share some of the latest research on motivational theory. No, Nehemiah told his story. And don't you find that a story can be very compelling, very inspiring, and very encouraging? They knew then that Nehemiah had a stake in this, that Nehemiah had a passion for what was going on. But even more than that, Nehemiah is addressing a couple of big concerns the people would have. Is this a God thing? This is such a monumentous task. Is God in this? Can you imagine Nehemiah sharing about his encounters with God, his prayer times with God, how God had moved graciously and miraculously back in Persia? And then the fact of what the king had said. Do you remember last week we indicated that one of Nehemiah's fears was this fear of failure? 12 years earlier, Ezra the priest and a group at the time that would have included some of these people in Nehemiah 2 had tried to rebuild the wall and they were stopped by King Artaxerxes, the very king who now had given Nehemiah permission to lead this rebuilding project. Nehemiah directly addresses the fear of failure that would have been there in the people, that would have been so demotivating, so discouraging. And Nehemiah saying, I've got this. I've done the groundwork. You don't need to worry about this. Remember a few years ago, a fellow here at the church who I think would have been a great elder, had all the qualifications, all the credentials, but he didn't want to be an elder because he had experienced failure in another church where he had been an elder. Failure can be a real obstruction to people moving forward. I commend Nehemiah for addressing it. Now, did you also notice that Nehemiah wasn't giving this as an edict or as a command? He wanted collaboration. That's why they replied. It may seem like an empty phrase, but they replied. Nehemiah is looking for their input, their agreement. They replied, let us start rebuilding. Can you imagine thousands of people in unison crying out, let us start rebuilding? That phrase, so they began the good work, is maybe not as strong as it could be. In the literal Hebrew, it actually means they began to strengthen their hands to do the good. It carries with it the implication that they were encouraged, they were strengthened by what Nehemiah said, and therefore responded to do this great thing. Where they had felt weak, they had now been strengthened. Where they felt hopeless, there was now hope. Where they were discouraged, they now experienced this surge of courage. Let us start rebuilding. I miss my times at Good Life with my son Mark. We hope that when things get better, we'll get back there. I remember in early January, Mark said, Dad, I'd like you to try this lift. And I looked at the weight, kind of looked at my own situation, and I said, Mark, I don't think I can do it. Mark, who in his football career has received a lot of good coaching, is actually a good coach, and he said, Dad, you can do it. And as I attempted the lift and then did a few other repetitions, Mark was going, you can do it, you can do it. And then I shifted from earlier saying, I can't, to I can. That's the pathway of motivation. When we start saying, I can't do this, look at all the reasons why I can't do it, to getting to a point where someone comes along, a good leader says, you can. That coach who says, you can do it, you can do it. And then getting to that point where you are able to agree and say, I can do it. The people of Jerusalem cry out, let us start rebuilding. Oh, they're going to face opposition. In a couple of weeks, we're going to talk very specifically about overcoming opposition. But for today, I would just like to leave you with three or four general observations, very quick, rapid-fire observations about motivation. In order to be an effective motivator, you need to know that people want to feel needed. They want to make a difference. They want to be involved in a good cause. That really is helpful for those of us who are called to motivate others. The other thing I want to talk about, and we addressed briefly last week, is it's not a matter of faith or leadership skills. It's both. Some of you might be saying, John, this talk recently about leadership and motivation, it's up to God to lead. It's God who motivates others. But no, I believe that God works in and through leaders. He often works in through others to motivate us. And so that area of this skill of motivating others being nurtured and developed is very important. Motivation also depends on mutually agreed to goals. What I love here is Nehemiah's goal for Jerusalem became the people's goal for Jerusalem as well. Let's rebuild the wall. I've met some leaders who have great goals, but no followers. And it doesn't work. In fact, there's something that's contradictory about the leader who would say, I'm on this path of leadership, but I have no followers. Someone has said about the journey of a leader who has no followers, you might as well just say you're out for a long walk, because leadership means that you have people you are influencing, you're impacting. There's people who are following your lead. Another thing I would say about motivation is motivation is something that needs to be unleashed, not superimposed on others. Now, we could talk a lot about the theology behind that. I believe that for the Christ follower who has Christ in him or her, we are unleashing that potential. Even for somebody who is not a Christ follower, we recognize the working of the Holy Spirit. But keep that notion in mind. We're unleashing the inner desires and ambitions of people rather than superimposing those or forcing them on people. Then my final point is a good motivator is self-motivated. They are consistent. How we are motivating others is consistent with how we are motivated. It's no good for me or others to try to motivate you to read Scripture if I'm not reading Scripture myself. It's no good for me to try to encourage you to pray regularly if I'm not praying regularly. We'll talk more about this in our series, but Nehemiah had the character. He had the godlikeness. He had the integrity of a good leader. Nehemiah, I'm not sure if he was the most charismatic leader, but he sure was a leader with substance. And I will always take substance over charisma. And in Nehemiah's case, he shows us what a good leader looks like. A good leader is always a good motivator. May God help you and guide you in the various areas and aspects of life where you are called to lead. Next week, as we move on to the rebuilding project, we will look at the importance of teamwork. Have a great week.